This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not like companies try to be number two in their markets, but when you've been in the second spot for 76 years, it does kind of hurt to get bumped down a notch. Auto sales numbers came out today and Ford fell farther back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 3rd of January. Good to have you here. What we're going to do, I think, is keep an eye on the big picture. Skip right over the quarterly figures we got today. Jump straight to the totals for 2007. General Motors announced this morning its sales dropped 6% last year. Ford tumbled 12%. Toyota gained almost 3%. That makes the Japanese carmaker the second largest seller of automobiles in this country behind GM. And it puts a sour note on Ford's turnaround efforts. The big blue oval now accounts for less than 13% of the American car market. The company's doing all it can to get healthy again. Ford said today it might have found a buyer for two of its luxury European brands, Jaguar and Land Rover. The top bidder isn't a private equity firm. The front runner is a company you might never have heard of, India's Tata Motors. We asked Marketplace's Jill Barshe why Ford is selling and why Tata.
Ford is struggling to keep its American auto business afloat. John Casessa is an analyst at Casessa Shapiro Group. He says Ford needs to sell Land Rover and Jaguar to raise cash.
Jaguar was always a problem child. It was acquired in the late 80s and has generally lost money since Ford has owned it, despite very substantial investment.
Land Rover SUVs have been doing better, but their appeal might fade as gas prices rise. So why would an Indian business want to take over these British auto headaches?
It's one man's trash is another man's treasure, and that's exactly the situation here.
Casessa says Tata has become rich as India has grown. The company's got more to invest than Ford. Plus, it's buying these brands on the cheap.
So this gives Tata relatively low-cost entry into the global auto business with brands that are recognized worldwide.
Global recognition is high on Tata's agenda. Arvind Subramanian writes about the Indian economy at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says Tata is India's largest auto company, but it's better known for its low-end vehicles. It's working on a car priced at $2,500 aimed at India's masses. Subramanian says Tata wants to aim higher.
Above all, it is about branding itself as a global player, as a global competitor. It signifies the arrival not just of Tata, but more generally of corporate India.
Subramanian says the acquisition of Land Rover and Jaguar are just what Tata needs to boost its ego. Premier hotel chain Orient Express recently rejected a takeover bid by Tata because the Indian company wasn't posh enough. In New York, I'm Jill Barshe from Marketplace.
It bears mention here that Ford's almost certainly going to lose money on this deal. Best guesses are Jaguar and Land Rover are going to fetch maybe $4 billion. Ford paid almost $5 for them. The Weather Channel could conceivably be worth $5 billion. The cable channel's parent company confirmed today it's exploring a possible sale of its holdings. From North Carolina Public Radio, Marketplace's Janet Babin has more.
Landmark Communications owns more than 50 community newspapers and 9 dailies. But these days, the gods of the media world are indifferent to print. Their holy grail is the Weather Channel.
Well, welcome back to your weather today. A very chilly morning for many of you.
Let's face it, even in this digital age, the weather is one of the few things that still affects everyone. And the Weather Channel is one of the last independently owned cable channels. Porter Bibb owns MediaTek Capital Partners. He tried to buy the Weather Channel back in the 90s for $600 million. But like lots of other suitors, Landmark turned him down. Now, Bibb thinks the channel's worth more than $5 billion, especially because it comes with a great website property.
Weather.com is one of the top-rated sites that's visited of any on the Internet. It has more daily visitors than Facebook, almost as many as MySpace and YouTube.
On TV, the channel's expanded its programming to include shows about global warming. Brian Steinberg writes for Advertising Age. He says fans these days aren't just vacationers stuck in hotel rooms.
There are people who won't leave the house until they watch that channel for 5 minutes.
Cable advertisers love the Weather Channel for other reasons, too. Paul Bond with The Hollywood Reporter says, like live sports, the weather happens now.
A lot of people watch live. They don't TiVo the TV shows and then skip through the commercials.
But the Weather Channel can sometimes look a bit rough around the edges. Commercials can cut into live shots, and anchors get stuck with the wrong graphics. But Bond says skimping on staff and equipment reins in costs.
That makes it all the more profitable, and people don't seem to mind that it looks amateurish.
Landmark wouldn't say why it's considering a sale now, but the core of its business is newspapers, an industry that's struggling for profitability. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The Securities and Exchange Commission wants to make it easier for Americans to dabble in foreign stocks. It's mulling a proposal that would let U.S. investors trade on other countries' exchanges. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports now from Washington.
We're not exactly talking about traders without borders. Average Joes would still only be able to invest in foreign stocks through mutual funds. It's our mutual funds that would have direct access to overseas markets. They wouldn't have to go through their foreign affiliates or other overseas middlemen. The foreign stocks would just pop up on their computer screens. Glenn Yeago of the Milken Institute likens this to opening up a Walmart.
The Walmarting of capital markets will lower the cost for all consumers by creating multiple access into multiple markets across the world.
This Walmart would be well stocked, but choosy. U.S. investors would only be able to buy stocks in markets that pretty much follow Wall Street rules. Moody'sEconomy.com senior economist Tu Packard says that's designed to shore up investor confidence.
U.S. investors can feel assured that the overseas markets that they would be buying shares in are as safe as their own markets.
The proposal could help mid-sized U.S. brokers who don't have foreign affiliates. Now, this isn't quite a done deal. All the SEC commissioners will say is they're developing a proposal on foreign investing. Former SEC Commissioner Edward Fleischman says it's no accident that reports of the proposal are hitting the headlines now. He says the SEC is
running it up the flagpole to see whether Congress or the public strongly objects.
Fleischman says the SEC has batted this proposal around internally for at least a year, and there have been similar plans in the past. Fleischman tried to talk up the idea when he was a commissioner 21 years ago. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Oil gave up just a smidge today. The major indices couldn't really make up their minds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. To be in Iowa tonight. Clear, 9 degrees above with the wind chill, or so weather.com tells me. Perfect weather for the caucuses. Unfortunately, lots of those meetings are going to happen right around dinner time, which will either mean some hungry caucus goers or lots of takeout. Steve Huebner manages the Domino's Pizza Place right in downtown Des Moines. We got him on the phone earlier today, and I asked him how he figured business is going to be tonight.
Oh my goodness, how many pizzas we're going to sell?
Yeah.
Oh, probably somewhere around 1,200 to 1,500.
Are you ready for it, do you think? Have you laid on extra staff?
We've got extra staff coming in. We're definitely ready for it. We've been making sure that everybody's trained up. We're ready for this. This is the kind of stuff we do all the time.
What about last time around, though? I understand in 2004 you were caught a little bit perhaps not so prepared.
Not quite. 2004 was the first year that I'd been the manager of that store, and stuff like that caught us by surprise. Now that I've been there for 4 years straight, for us this is almost routine.
Now, is there one campaign that orders more pizza than any other campaign?
I probably shouldn't be speaking about what my customers are ordering, but you know, I would say that we do get a good mix of all sides of the ticket.
Now, are you going to miss everybody when they're gone?
yes, absolutely. This is a fun week for us. It's a great way for us to start off the new year.
Steve Huebner is the manager of the Domino's Pizza in downtown Des Moines, Iowa. Steve, good luck tonight.
Thank you very much for the phone call.
One thing I forgot to ask Steve was how many of his orders come in online, which, although it sounds random, isn't quite as random a segue as it might sound, because the Internet may well be the deciding factor in this year's caucuses and also in the money race that's already well underway. Author Garrett Graff worked for the Internet candidate last time around, Howard Dean, who finished third in Iowa, by the way. But Graff says this year's campaigns have taken their web work to another level.
I think the biggest difference between 2004 and 2008 is that this is really the first campaign of the Internet age. You know, you have Hillary Clinton competing out right there with Barack Obama and John Edwards and Mitt Romney, and sort of all of these folks are really putting a lot of effort into their Internet operations.
And let's think about what we have. We have YouTube and MySpace and Facebook and cell phones and all that stuff. Who, in your considered professional opinion, is doing it best?
Well, I would draw two distinctions. The first is, I think that Barack Obama's campaign has been the best at sort of innovating as a campaign in the way that it's organizing its supporters and building support online, raising money, getting supporters' cell phones to send them text messages. But the big story online in 2008 has actually, I think, been Ron Paul, whose own campaign hasn't been doing all that much, but whose supporters have really been doing a tremendous amount of garnering support and raising money. They've even actually raised money to launch a blimp that has been plastered with Ron Paul signs and has been traveling up and down the East Coast.
Let's skip ahead to tomorrow morning for a second. We will have the numbers in. We'll know who won or who didn't. And I want to play out two scenarios for you. One is that there is a clear winner, whether it's Senator Clinton or Senator Obama or John Edwards. They will be able to capitalize almost immediately now, for the first time, really, in modern politics in America, and translate that win into money virtually instantaneously, right, via the web.
Indeed. In 1984, we saw Gary Hart upset Walter Mondale in the New Hampshire primary. But Hart's campaign was unable to really capitalize on that win because they couldn't get the money in fast enough. In that age, you know, you had to send out a letter asking for money. People had to mail you back a check. You had to collect the check, deposit the check, wait for the check to clear. What we're going to see happen tonight is whomever wins is going to be hit with a flood of online credit card donations. And so a campaign could be almost broke tonight and yet wake up tomorrow morning with potentially millions of dollars in the bank to continue their campaign.
Let me play out, though, what could be an equally possible scenario for this evening, that the three Democratic-leaning candidates finish in a statistical dead heat. The two Republicans finish in a statistical dead heat. We really have nobody winning, and all this money out there, credit cards at the ready, sort of waiting to figure out what to do.
But I think that whomever wins tonight, someone will be very excited by the results. You know, even if John Edwards places a strong second, or Barack Obama places a strong second, or John Edwards upsets with the win, even if it's only by a point or two, and that will motivate people to get online and give tonight in, you know, $25, $50, $100 donations. And certainly with all of these primaries over the space of this month, that could be tremendously advantageous to whomever is sort of perceived, quote unquote, as the winner.
The book by Garrett Graff is called The First Campaign. It's about globalization, the web, and the race for the White House. He's also an editor at Washingtonian Magazine. Garrett, thanks a lot for coming in.
A pleasure. Thank you.
We want to know if the presidential candidates are addressing your concerns. Tell us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Election 2008. It's probably no accident four of the top six candidates in Iowa, three Democrats and one Republican, went to law school. Because lawyers just seem to have this itch for a good fight. Did you hear the one about the two trial lawyer groups that are suing each other? Commentator Jeff Birnbaum explains.
Lawyers are always suing each other. After all, that's what they do. But lately, a particular set of lawyers, trial lawyers to be exact, have gone to court over what to call themselves. Last year, the Association of Trial Lawyers of America changed its name to the more highbrow American Association for Justice. Around the time of the change, an upstart group of lawyers created a new organization, its name, the American Trial Lawyers Association. Sound similar? Well, yeah. But the new group says the old group abandoned the name, putting it or anything pretty much like it up for grabs. Not so, says the American Association for Justice. It filed suit to prevent the new group from using anything even close to its old acronym, ATLA. On top of that, yet another group, the American College of Trial Lawyers, has also filed suit. The new group, it says, sounds entirely too much like itself. The freshly minted American Trial Lawyers Association, appropriately enough, is fighting back, and of course, in court. But here's my question. Why bother? The term trial lawyer has got to be one of the most reviled phrases on the planet. Corporate lobbyists have spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to convince the public that trial lawyers are no good, money-grubbing, company-killing parasites. And those are the nice things they say. National polls have long shown that the term trial lawyers is a huge burden for plaintiffs' attorneys of all kinds, even those who don't sue corporations for a living. A survey in October by the Anti-Trial Lawyer Institute for Legal Reform showed that the name Association of Trial Lawyers of America is viewed unfavorably by six times as many people as its new name, the American Association for Justice. Indeed, that kind of finding is why the trial lawyers group changed its name in the first place. The phrase trial lawyers is basically an epithet. If some organization wants to call itself that, nobody should sue to stop, even, pardon the expression, trial lawyers.
Jeff Birnbaum is a columnist at the Washington Post. Send along your lawyer jokes or anything else you'd like to tell us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, some Aussie lawyers try out a new business model.
The Australian legal profession has a fairly conservative streak, and sometimes that's put us at odds with our professional colleagues.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials closed up a tenth of 1%, 12 points, to end the day at 13,056. The NASDAQ moved down a quarter of 1%, 6 points, finished at 2602. The S&P 500 traded pretty much flat at 1447. Monsanto sprouted 8.5% today. That after big sales in Latin America lifted the seed makers' profits to record levels. The big drugstore chains looked a bit queasy, though. A slow start to the cold and flu season sent shares of Rite Aid 15% lower. That's, I guess, we're not sick enough, I suppose. While Walgreens and CVS Caremark each lurched more than 6% lower. December was a real clunker for General Motors. As we told you, shares chugged down 2% today. Bonds traded basically flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note ended the day at 3.9%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases December unemployment figures. Nancy Pelosi was elected Speaker of the House 1 year ago. She's the first woman to hold the position. And if you've got a brain full of facts with no useful outlet, tomorrow presents an opportunity to share your knowledge. January 4th is Trivia Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I'm going to read you a list of company names now. I want you to tell me what they have in common, all right? Here we go. PapaJohns.com, Champs Sports, Meineke Car Care, here's another one, Chick-fil-A. Any guesses? Anyone? Bueller? If you've been watching any college football the past couple of weeks, you ought to be able to come up with this one. They're just some of the companies that are sponsoring what's become an explosion of college bowl games. Diana Nyad's been keeping track for us. Diana, how are you?
I'm well. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Happy New Year.
Yep, same.
So listen, here's what I want to know about all these bowl games. You ready? How did some of these teams get in there?
It's confounding.
It's, you know, bewildering, one might say.
It's been decades that people have been arguing the postseason of football. You know, it's a grand, you know, regular season with upsets and, you know, and fervor and school spirit. And then you come to the postseason. I mean, they made up 64 teams that some of them had losing records during the season, but they get to go to bowls. So when you say, how did they get in? How did the University of Colorado, Maryland? I mean, there's several teams in here who went under 500 for the year. Do you think those players and those coaches said to themselves, wow, we deserve to be in a bowl.
All right.
We're
now,
in the big time.
Now you're being cynical. Seriously, what's the deal, though?
Well, then the deal is money. I mean, when you think that a team like University of Colorado at 6'7", you know, what are they playing for? Yeah, they're playing for money. There is a huge, huge bonanza of 32 television rights fees, 32 cities that are bringing in the revenue of, you know, restaurant, retail, whatever that happens during the big weekend of the game. Okay, so it's a bonanza for the NCAA. Great. It supports all these football teams. Great. But that's a financial decision. Is that what sport's all about?
All right. Well, let me get back to that, right? So, we build this segment as the business of sports. Let's do the sports of the business. There's no real good sports going on here. I mean, last night's football game was a 20-point blowout. The two on New Year's Day were 30 or 31-point blowout. I mean, it's crazy.
There's a lot of that, and there's the fact that we are going to watch next Monday what's been told to us is going to be the national championship game. So they picked LSU and Ohio State,
yep.
And great, they're fine football teams, but what if you were with the University of Georgia right now, or USC, not to mention? You would say, you know, what the heck? Shouldn't we have had a chance to play those teams and move through a bracket like a traditional playoff system and make it to the final ourselves, prove it on the field rather than just taking a computer ranking system? You know, I'd be mad as heck if I were a bulldog.
How about this, though? It's college football, men's football at this level, which generates the revenue for these colleges, which lets women's tiddlywinks and co-ed naked volleyball and all those other sports happen that would not otherwise be possible without all this revenue.
Well, that's true, but easy. That's an easy solution. What if you had a 16-team playoff? Okay, so that means you're going to move through 4 weeks a month through playing, you know, once a week, and that final team will be standing. And so each team that moves through there, you imagine the revenue that would be produced by a championship, you know, game would be close to the Super Bowl, honestly. What if all those teams had to share whatever revenue comes in with their conferences? All that money-making right now is distributed, and that sounds great and very fair. It could still be distributed within the conferences.
Have you called the NCAA about this?
You know, they don't really care what I think.
But we do. Diana Nyad and the Business of Sports. Thank you, Diana.
Thank you.
The Australian law firm Slater and Gordon made $9.5 million U.S. last calendar year. Not much in the grand scheme of things, we know, but it is the first time that a law firm has ever had to report its earnings. Slater and Gordon started selling shares on the Australian Securities and Exchange this past May, making it the first publicly traded law office in the world. Nate DeMeo went down under to see what that might mean for lawyers and for investors.
Have you been injured in an accident? Do you or someone you love suffer from mesothelioma from exposure to asbestos on the job? Are you looking for a mid-cap stock with strong investment potential?
You know, you could get more if you talk to a lawyer.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know who to call.
Slater and Gordon.
Call the Slater and Gordon Legal Helpline.
In 1935, a couple of Melbourne lawyers started representing union workers in claims against the railroads. Today, Slater & Gordon has more than 20 offices across Australia, from Adelaide to Wollongong. It's got ads all over the TV, and a managing director named Andrew Greck, who likes shaking things up.
The Australian legal profession has a fairly conservative streak, and sometimes that's put us at odds with our professional colleagues, but I think we pride ourselves on being innovators.
It took several years of wrangling with regulators to win Slater and Gordon a place in the Sydney Stock Exchange. Greg says that it's changed the whole dynamic of its business. He says the partnership model stopped working for Slater and Gordon.
The traditional models for ownership really lacked the flexibility necessary to reward talented young lawyers early enough in their career.
He asks, why would a talented young lawyer want to come to his firm and toil away for years with no guarantee of making partner? They're afraid to take time off. They're afraid that having kids will knock them off track. Now, he says, the firm can offer stock options and be flexible and reward its employees in any number of ways, like a normal business. But should a law firm be able to act like a normal business?
I could see situations in which non-lawyers could interfere in the business of a law firm.
Stephen Crane chairs the Ethics Committee of the American Bar Association. He says he can't imagine there'll be a time when firms will be allowed to list in the New York or London stock exchanges, because they shouldn't be normal businesses. Lawyer jokes and maybe public perception aside, he says that law firms adhere to an ethical code that doesn't apply to other companies.
When you allow outside influences to come into play, the client is no longer getting the best judgment of the lawyer. They're getting the judgment of the lawyer tempered or perhaps controlled by someone who is not inculcated in the morals of the profession.
He says firms are afraid of not knowing who's going to have a say in how they run their business. What happens, for instance, if investors demand that a firm drops a client whose case doesn't look winnable? Andrew Grech says that doesn't happen at Slater and Gordon. He says there are walls and regulations in place that make sure it won't. And anyway, as a public company, it's transparent. Who knows what's happening behind closed doors at one of those high-powered London or Manhattan firms with their tiny pool of very powerful clients?
The conflicts for them are enormous. They are typically very, very dependent on a very, very small pool of clients. That's a far greater risk to professional independence and ethical behavior than being a listed company.
He says Slater and Gordon doesn't make its money writing contracts or reviewing trusts. It makes its money by winning cases. Just about as simple as that. It's direct, it's cutthroat, and it's been extremely lucrative. From where he stands, it sounds like the sort of thing a lot of people on Wall Street could get behind. In Melbourne, Australia, I'm Nate DeMeo for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today before you go. Imagine you're cruising along on your way to work and then bam! You hit traffic and crawl the rest of the way to the office. We've all been there, and as of today, you can blame cell phones in part for that highway jam. Researchers at the University of Utah say drivers who are yammering away on the phone drive 2 miles an hour slower than those who aren't. If you consider that about 1 in 10 of us are on the phone behind the wheel, the extra chatter increases commutes by 20 hours a year. And those hands-free devices, not so much. The study says they don't speed things up because it's the conversation that's distracting you people, not the phone. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 12 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ gave up 6 points, that's 0.25%. The S&P 500 finished flat. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, family mission statements. Are they brilliant or a bust?
Unless you're showing and leading by example, I don't think they're worth the paper they're written on.
That would be bust then. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.